In 2012, you may recall Superstorm Sandy moving up from Cuba, Jamaica, destroying towns all along the eastern coast of the United States. Well, I was in seminary at that time. I was living in Manhattan in an apartment with one of my friends. And I remember my dad calling and saying, you know, do you have provisions for at least 2 weeks? Water, you know, do you have flashlights? Do you have food? What's your emergency plan if the wind was strong, you know, if there was flooding? And he'd mapped out our part of the city. We were in Morningside Heights, which is near Harlem, and we actually were on one of the only major hills in Manhattan, so we felt good about that. And my friend and I were just sort of thinking, okay, you know, thanks, Dad, I'm sure it's going to be bad. It's not going to be that bad. This is New York City. Nothing happens to New York City. Well, we felt like school children getting ready for a snowstorm and looking forward to a day off. And we cuddled up to watch movies until we lost power. And all night, the wind did howl, and there was heavy rain. And at my seminary, we had these very thin glass pane windows, so you could actually feel the wind through the windows, and they were shaking a little bit. But for the most part, it was fine where we were. And we thought, okay, just as we thought, everything's all right. But 2 days later, we decided to go for a run at night, which is one of the things we like to do, and see what, you know, the city looked like a little south of us. So we ran along the Hudson River, and it's never dark in New York City, so you can run really at any time. And we cut over at about 44th Street and turned south on Broadway, and it was like the floor fell away. It was pitch black. You could not see that there was a lower half of Manhattan. And I just remember it was such a visceral experience for me. You know, this constant comfort of the noise and lights that are always there, just gone. We couldn't see them. There's no power. Our seminary helped coordinate all kinds of recovery efforts. You could go to Chinatown to help bring food and water to elderly folks who were living on the 13th or 25th or 43rd floor of their apartments. The elevators were out. There were food drives to bring non-perishables to folks without working refrigerators. Lower Manhattan was back in the 19th century, it felt like. And in many ways, the destruction of Superstorm Sandy was a great equalizer, because people who lived in high-rise apartments and people who didn't still had to climb some serious stairs every day for a long time. But in other ways, it was not a great equalizer. The endpoints of the subway lines changed because of flooding, and a lot of travel on the subways just ended. And for some, this meant taking more cabs than usual, but for others, it meant standing in really long lines for buses and walking much further than they usually would. And I'll never forget going into Lower Manhattan and seeing some of the buildings near Wall Street. Some of these grand buildings with marble floors and gold lettering and these grand busts of important men in the lobby. There's this clean opulence to these lobbies and stoic people in trendy shoes and suits click-clacking their way through. My aunt once took me to one of these lobbies when I was 13, and I just was awed by how grand it was. You know, just a lobby, so beautiful. But after Superstorm Sandy, I saw in this one lobby the cream and gold-colored wallpaper was peeling, and it smelled like a dank basement, and there was dirt drying between the floor tiles. Of course, I knew on an intellectual level that even Manhattan could be taken down by nature, but seeing this much damage to such a powerful city shook me at a more subconscious level. I hadn't even been harmed or experienced any damage personally. We have built such a powerful, intricate infrastructure, it's easy to forget that the human-made life of organized convenience, especially in our country, is not invincible and not permanent. Let me tell you, I have avoided preaching on this topic for a very long time because it's overwhelming to think about climate change for me. Also, they teach you a rule that when you preach on something, you're supposed to have done enough therapy, be in a good amount of peace with whatever the topic is, so that you aren't doing messy, unfulfilling therapy in front of the congregation. You can talk about upsetting things, but only if you're in a good place with them. And when it comes to climate change, I think I am in the midst of what Swiss psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross calls the stages of grieving. There are five stages of grief in Kubler-Ross's construct, and the first is denial. This isn't happening. Anger, I'm angry that this is happening. Bargaining, if I do this, maybe I can undo what's happening or what I feel because of it. Depression, I feel helpless, defeated. And then acceptance. This is happening. What can we do to move forward? We are losing the world as we have known it, and that is cause for grief. Our society, depending on where you look, is somewhere between the stages of denial, anger, and bargaining. There are still folks who deny that we are going to lose the world as we have known it. There is plenty of anger and finger-pointing about whose fault it is that we are in this mess. And there's even a little bargaining going on. Okay, oil companies can drill here, but they can't drill here, and we'll invest in some alternative energy. The United States is bargaining all the time when it comes to climate change. But we have to look ahead and make changes, but we don't want to change the makeup of our economy, which relies so heavily on fossil fuels. Another problem is that not every country is going through the same stage of grief. This makes it difficult to communicate with one another if the world's most economically powerful countries are closer to the denial and bargaining phase, while parts of the developing world are already in the final stages of depression and acceptance. For example, Christopher, and I'm going to pronounce his last name Lauk, president of the Marshall Islands, he wept in front of the other leaders of world countries at the gathering of the United Nations. And he was crying because the Marshallese are watching their country disappear underwater. And their culture is very much tied to the land. Being an island nation is one of the physical markers of their way of life, their social identity. Charles Haney wrote an article in 2010 for the Huffington Post about the Marshall Islands, asking, "What happens if the 61,000 Marshallese must abandon their low-lying home? Would they still be a nation? With the United Nations seat? With control of their old fisheries and their underwater minerals? Where would they live? How would they make a living? Who precisely would they and their children become?" Hearing about the impending fate of the Marshall Islands highlights a disturbing trend. The people who will suffer the most from global climate change are the people who have contributed the least to the problem. The people who live in low-impact homes made of clay and straw all around the world, who do not drive, who do not fly, or buy products imported from thousands of miles away. Countries that are only now hitting their industrial revolution or haven't hit it yet. People without air conditioning and heat, people without large, reliable refrigerators will suffer the most from the effects of climate change. And the truth is, people around the world who occupy the middle and upper class will continue to adapt, people like me, to the challenges of climate change for a long time. Acceptance is Kubler-Ross's final step of grief, and the stage in which something productive can be done. We have to accept the fact that we are losing the world as we have known it, and we have to accept that we do indeed live in an interdependent web of life in which those with more are accountable to those with less. Moving forward after accepting these truths will require a lot of spiritual discipline. The spiritual discipline of reverence will serve us well. We heard Rachel Carson in our reading this morning describing a sad truth. She wrote, "My companion and I were alone with the stars, the misty river of the Milky Way flowing across the sky. The patterns of the constellations standing out bright and clear, a blazing planet low on the horizon. It occurred to me that if this were a sight that could be seen only once in a century, this little headland would be thronged with people. But because it can be seen on many scores of nights, at all times of the year, perhaps it will never be seen." We must have reverence for the beauty of the earth, not admire the natural world fleetingly, but engage in it. And this is possible for all of us. We could eat a plum and be aware of the stickiness in our palm, the sweet, sour smell, and the contrast in color when you take a bite of the deep purple skin and then the pink and orange interior. If we feel wind, why not stop and let the wind do what it wants with your hair? Smooth our faces, ruffle our clothes. We have to let the natural world break through the haze of our daily lives. If we practice the spiritual discipline of reverence of the natural world, wouldn't it be harder to ignore or forget the harm we are causing? Wouldn't we all stop using plastic bags and teach every retail store, every grocery store, that manufacturing them is a waste of time and resources? Wouldn't we all buy local food? Wouldn't we become like the hummingbird in our children's story and each do what we can, each do our best? If all those individual efforts added up, wouldn't we teach our global economy to have different priorities? If we practice the spiritual discipline of reverence for the natural world, maybe as individuals we could simply refuse to consume excess. Knowing as we look up at the patterns of the constellations, bright and clear, that this is enough, this is plenty. I know for some of us this sounds impossible. And sometimes I think that no amount of reverence for the earth is going to make me want to give up my thoughtless comfort and convenience in my daily life. But I was taught growing up, sometimes through subliminal messages, sometimes overtly and directly, that the world is an endless resource for me to consume. And I was watching my little cousin, who I've told you about before. She made gravy with powdered sugar last year. She was 6 years old, and she was watching her dad in the kitchen, and he threw out an empty can of refried beans. And Kirsten did not like that. She was very upset with her dad and tried to explain what recycling is. And we're going to run out of cans, Dad, one day, and you're putting stress on our earth. And my uncle smiled and admitted that he'd just been too lazy to wash out the refried beans and get it ready for recycling, which I have done one too many times. But Kirsten is not learning that the world is something to be endlessly consumed. In her school classes, in the stories she is going to grow up hearing about climate change, she is learning to see the world as a precious and fragile place, where all resources are not to be taken for granted. And Kirsten's reverence for the earth gives me hope. There are all kinds of other spiritual disciplines to continue practicing right now as we want to prepare for losing the world as we have known it. We need to practice compassion. Our hearts are overloaded by all the stories of woe we hear from around the world every day. But somehow we have to stretch our compassion, make it large enough and durable to truly notice and honor the billions of people who will be most vulnerable to the destruction and hardship climate change will cause. We have to stretch and strengthen our compassion with small, daily actions, uncalled for kindness toward one another, so that if called upon, we will be ready to give some measure of comfort and convenience up for the good of another. We Unitarian Universalists will need reverence and compassion to sustain us, because we will continue to be called to live our faith with more and more conviction. If we truly value all human life, if we believe we are accountable and responsible for our part of the interdependent web of life, then we are called to mourn the loss of the world as we have known it. We are called to slowly but surely accept what is happening on our planet and greet the changes with fierce reverence for the earth and fierce compassion for the human beings who live on it. May we wake up and call each other to these disciplines of spirit daily. Blessed be. Amen.